content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we will begin today with Another Symptom of Growing Isolation, written by Olga Kazan. In Europe in the 1700s, coffee houses were sources of coffee, but also conversation. As the MIT psychologist Sherry Turkle points out in her 2016 book, Reclaiming Conversation, many people went to coffee houses specifically to have rich, deep, sometimes even confrontational discussions. She quotes the British essayist and politician Joseph Addison, who wrote in 1714, quote, "I have taken particular care never to be of the same opinion with the man I conversed with," end quote. Contrast this with how, some 300 years later, I engage with my local coffee house, Starbucks. I open the app at home and order a latte, then whirl my Honda through the drive-thru and collect my drink from an employee who says, "Have a nice day." No conversation, just caffeine. This new way of obtaining Java is a part of why, according to a recent study published in the journal Perspectives on Psychological Science, people now are talking less and less. For the study, the psychologist Valeria Pfeiffer of the University of Missouri at Kansas City and Matthias Mayle of the University of Arizona analyzed data from thousands of participants in the United States, Mexico, Australia, and Europe. The subjects carried around a device that randomly recorded sound bites of their speech throughout the day. In 2005, when the studies began, the average number of words that each participant spoke in a day was 16,632. In 2019, when the research concluded, the average was 11,900. Each year, the participants spoke about 338 fewer words a day than they did in the previous year, amounting to a decline of about 28% over the entire time period. From what I can tell, the two main reasons seem to be driving this gradual silencing. The first is that conversation requires, at the very least, the presence of another person. But during the study period, people almost everywhere spent more and more time alone, a trend that only accelerated after the study ended, as the pandemic drove millions of people into further isolation. One major paper found that from 2003 to 2019, the portion of free time that Americans spent alone grew from about 44% to about 49%. Which may sound like a small increase until you consider that the study excludes time spent working, sleeping, and grooming. In 2006, 21% of the respondents to a survey in 21 European countries said they got together daily with friends. By 2022, that number was just 12%. The other big factor is the rise of digital communication, such as texting and social media, as well as online shopping, ordering, and many, many other things. A generation ago, many of the tasks of daily life required conversations with the grocery store cashier, at the receptionist at the doctor's office, the host at a neighborhood restaurant. But today, Pfeiffer told me, you can reserve a table using an app as opposed to calling the restaurant. She added, the conversations you have with strangers or maybe people that you don't know as well, the opportunity for those just seemed to have declined a lot in recent years. Opportunities for speaking with people one does know also have declined, as people tend to send a text or direct message instead of calling a friend on the phone. Whatever the reason for the decline of talking, it could have negative consequences for mental health. Turkle said that unlike texting or emailing, face-to-face conversation builds empathy. We experience the emotion of conversation from within our bodies. In her book, she points to a study in which researchers compared college friends who communicated face-to-face and by video chat, audio chat, and online instant messaging. In-person conversation led to the most emotional connection, she writes, and online messaging led to the least. Even the loss of relatively shallow conversations can be harmful. Gillian Sandstrom, a psychologist at the University of Sussex and the author of Once Upon a Stranger, studies weak ties, or the people we talk with casually throughout the day. She has found that although these interactions might seem meaningless, they boost our sense of well-being, making us feel part of something bigger, even if we're just buying milk or chatting with a colleague at the office coffee maker. And when we have fewer of these exchanges, we miss them. A recent study in the journal Science, for example, found that remote workers spend most time alone each workday and also experience more mental distress than in-person workers. The effects were especially pronounced if the remote worker also lived solo. Talking less can also create a self-reinforcing cycle. When we don't practice having small interactions, Sandstrom told me, then we feel more anxious, and then we don't want to do it. But these casual interactions sometimes lead to big, important relationships. How will I find my best friend that I don't know that I have if I'm too nervous to talk to people? Declines in speech are also a problem, Pfeiffer said, because talking exercises the brain differently than texting does. When you have a conversation, your working memory has to retain both what the other person is telling you and what you're planning to say in response. An in-person discussion is even more complicated. You have to monitor your body posture and facial expressions so that you react appropriately to what the other person says. When you're talking face-to-face, you can't mutter, "What the hell?" while typing out sounds great. Plus, Pfeiffer said, in verbal communication, you can't edit or read back what was said, which means you organize your thoughts differently or perhaps try out some ideas you're not willing to chisel in stone quite yet. When conversation skills get rusty, other cognitive processes might erode too, Pfeiffer told me. Many people struggle with their attention span, she said, and that could be partly because we don't have as many chances as we once did to try to follow along as someone tells a lengthy, complicated story. When so much communication happens digitally, she said, we're essentially outsourcing a lot of the way our brain works into a device. When I use the Starbucks app and similar shortcuts, it's typically because I don't want to face the uncomfortable spontaneity of other humans. What if they say something weird? Or I do? But considering this research, I might let more of my own clumsy comments fly and be more receptive to the ones that come my way. I'd rather say something weird, I think, than not say anything at all. Our second story. The World Cup could not be Americanized. Written by Sally Jenkins. A World Cup on North American soil ended with the most thoroughly imported overseas-style final match possible. The foreign tourists who tried to smuggle ranch dressing through TSA, the Norwegians who scarfed down Texas brisket while doing the Viking row at Dallas barbecue joints, the garish out-of-place halftime show in a New Jersey football stadium, all of that Americanness was overcome in the end by the classic continental display of footwork and defense in Spain's 1-0 victory over Argentina. This event just could not be Americanized, hard as Donald Trump, the Fox Network, and the Muppets tried. Men's soccer did not become American at this World Cup, and America still really does not play men's soccer. Real soccer looked like this. One tap, two taps, then flights of red Spanish jerseys surging toward the goal. La Roya played with such elegant staccato, soft-shoed ball that they seemed to have 20 men on the field instead of 11. With their quick-step precision, they completed a dazzling 789 passes. Sorry, but Americans just don't kick it like that. Not yet, anyway. Fully 89% of Spain's touches, whether nosing the ball along or lashing it, went right where they intended. But the game, almost incomprehensibly, also looked like this. Despite Spain's brilliance, it was a scoreless tie right up until the 105th minute of extra time, when Ferran Torres laced a goal with a left footer to the high back net. All of the novelty was thanks to the record-breaking heroics of Argentina's goalie Damian Emiliano Dibu Martinez, who had 11 saves, the most recorded in a final since the World Cup began keeping stats. He launched himself sideways again and again to get his gloves on Spain's ballistic leg whips. Spain completely dominated. They took 20 shots overall, compared with just 2 for Argentina. And yet they could have lost. That's, quote, the football, end quote, for you. It's a game of low scores, which can mean rough justice. A team can be clearly superior and not get a bit of what it deserves. As Argentina's captain, Lionel Messi, reflected a couple of years ago in a TV interview, in football you can be 10 times better than your opponent and still lose. He added, these things in football are different, difficult to explain no matter how much you analyze and study it. This game was likely the final World Cup appearance for Messi, the greatest player of his generation, if not all time, whom Spain limited to just one shot, which was blocked. Argentina had trouble even getting the ball in Spain's half of the field, unable to make connections against a quicker-toed, fast-closing defense that gave up just a single goal in its 8 World Cup matches. Yet Messi still managed to create a sense of late drama with his hooking passes across the face of Spain's net, conjuring sudden opportunities out of nothing. American players just don't seem to have the kind of threat in their shoes. Think about the difference between American soccer prodigies and a Messi, who took up the game at age 3 or 4 in his sprawling home city of Rosario. The son of a house cleaner and a supervisor in a metal factory, he played for a local nonprofit club that sometimes didn't have enough practice balls to go around. His footwork is partly a function of improvised games he played by himself as a boy. As he related in an early TV interview, he would juggle oranges and tennis balls off his insteps. He could kick an orange 60 times in a row without it hitting the ground, a tennis ball 120 times. One of Messi's earliest coaches, Carlo Marconi, once recalled that he baited Messi for cookies with every goal he scored. Messi had a particular passion for alfajores, caramel-flavored treats, and would score 4 or 5 goals a game to get them. He scored so often that Marconi decided to change the game. He would give Messi a double reward if he could score on a header, Marconi recalled. So what did he do? He would start here, dribble past everyone, get to the goal, kick the ball up with his foot, and then score with his head. Then he'd say, to me, 2. But Marconi also remembers that Messi would divide the spoils among his teammates, handing out alfajores to the other boys. Marconi said he ended up giving Messi cookies for free. Here, take it. I'm giving it to you not because you're a good player, but because you're a good person. That story almost certainly wouldn't happen today in America, for the simple reason that the youth soccer culture here is mainly built on a profit-driven pay-to-play system. Parents fork over heavy fees to enroll their child in local clubs that charge for training, field rentals, coaching, and travel. As a result, soccer remains a mostly suburban, middle and upper class sport. Not that soccer is the only game that requires American parents to dig into their pockets. According to one study, the cost of all youth sports rose by 46% from 2019 to 2025. The cure for this problem is not more spending. The U.S. Soccer Federation spent more than $6 million in yearly salary and incentives on an illustrious European head coach, Mauricio Pochettino, Yet his overhyped team was beaten badly the minute they faced a top 10 ranked team. Belgium's 4-1 victory over the U.S. in the round of 16 came despite intercession by the American president to have the suspension of the U.S.'s best player, Fuleran Balogun, overturned after he was given a red card. Overturned this, the Belgium team posted on its social media account after the game. Balogun, by the way, is really the product of British, not American, soccer. He has U.S. birthright citizenship because he was born in Brooklyn to a Nigerian mother who was merely visiting. He was reared and trained in London. Trump's heavy shoulder lean on FIFA regarding the red card, "I was the one who got them to do it," he acknowledged, soured much of the goodwill that foreign fans may have had toward the U.S. as a co-host of the tournament. Unfortunately, another breach of FIFA rules and tradition came at halftime of the final and didn't win many friends over either. FIFA mandates that halftime should be no longer than 15 minutes. Soccer, real football, is a game of rhythm and fluidity with only a brief break. There had never been a halftime show at a World Cup. Yet because this World Cup was in America, a halftime show there was. The verdict on the 27-minute Festival of Gaudiness featuring Madonna, Justin Bieber, Shakira, and various Muppet characters is that America showed off better when it didn't try quite so hard. It was a relief when Spain retook the field, restoring the sense of elegance and leaving a far more lingering imprint on the field. Today's third story, "Just Ask the Dinosaurs How Bad Air Quality Can Get," written by Nancy Walicki. The air quality this week is bad. Smoke from Canadian wildfires has turned the sky orange in Philadelphia. It has veiled the Statue of Liberty in Manhattan. In Detroit, which has dealt with some of the worst conditions in the country, the smoke has almost entirely blurred the city's skyline. The eastern United States isn't exactly accustomed to smoke days, which can prompt someone like me, from the wildfire-prone West, to brag about how they've seen far worse. But those smoke days are nothing compared with the ones 66 million years ago. If you want to talk about bad air quality, ask the dinosaurs. The asteroid that spelled the beginning of their end struck the Earth at about 40,000 miles an hour, blasting a 112-mile-wide crater into Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. The explosion was so big that it punched a hole into the atmosphere, bringing outer space down to the surface of the Earth, Kirk Johnson, the director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, told me. The impact flung trillions of tons of debris into the air, and much of it headed right into the yawning atmosphere and into Earth's orbit. As the planet continued to rotate, you basically got a global cloud of dust and debris that blocked sunlight from hitting the ground, Johnson said, and it blocked virtually all of the sunlight, plunging the world into solar eclipse-level darkness. Some hot debris fell back down from the atmosphere, and within minutes, wildfires were spreading. Enormous conflagrations combusted all of the biomass on the planet, not just some forests in Canada, Johnson said. And with debris blocking the sun, those wildfires were burning in a dark world. Given the worldwide fires, dinosaurs would have been trapped in a level of smoke far more intense than the kind of downwind exposure that the U.S. experienced this week. Brian Toon, a senior research scientist at the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado Boulder, told me, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately for them, many dinosaurs were not alive to experience this global wildfire pitch-black hellscape. The asteroid impact event was a massive atomic blast-scale thing, like 1 billion Hiroshimas of energy released, Johnson said. The dinosaurs within about 1,000 miles of the impact site died just by being exploded, basically, he said. And given the magnitude of the blast, if you were a human-sized animal standing anywhere on the planet at the surface, your survival of the first week is pretty unlikely. Other creatures perished during the ensuing climate mayhem. Within a week, maybe for months, the brightest day would have looked more like a moonlit night, Ken McLeod, a geology professor at the University of Missouri, told me. The air wasn't just smoky, he said. It was loaded with dust and gases. The gloom lasted for about 2 years, as particulates from the asteroid impact remained in the atmosphere and soot from wildfires added to them. The next couple of decades were very low light, very difficult for photosynthesis to occur, which led herbivores to starve, Brian Huber, a research geologist at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, told me. At what point would the atmosphere of this dark, foreign planet have settled into something like a haze hanging over Detroit today? No one was totally sure. I would bet years, decades after, Huber said. Johnson estimated that it would have been about a couple of years after impact. Curators at New York City's American Museum of Natural History found that 40% of sunlight was still blocked 2 years after the asteroid event, the museum told me. Although most soot and dust particles went away within a few years, sulfate aerosols continued to create a global orange-brown smog, the dinosaur extinction exhibit notes. According to the museum, it was only about 4 years after the asteroid arrived that full sunlight reappeared. The era in which the dinosaurs perished would be unrecognizable to a modern person. Compared with that, the air pollution Americans are facing right now, Huber said, ain't nothing. Scientists know all of this in part because of the sheer amount of charcoal and soot, millions and millions of tons of it, that fell to the ground, left traces that are still detectable today. The asteroid itself also left a thin layer of debris made of meteorite and ancient parts of what we now call Mexico. You can touch it in Trinidad Lake State Park in southern Colorado, Toon said. Evidence from a time in this planet's history when things looked pretty much as apocalyptic as one could imagine. So yes, the smoke this week is bad. The outdoor air quality is poor, and people should take precautions to limit the amount of it they're breathing. And yet, there is something to be grateful for each day. And today, it is that we are not dinosaurs. Next, music's new superstar is here, and she's rather relaxed, by Spencer Kornhaber. Whitney Houston and Mariah Carey are two of music's great masters of emotional excess, and it's long seemed fitting that they've shared one of Billboard's highest achievements, the longest-running Hot 100 number one for a solo woman. That record was set over 14 weeks by Houston's I Will Always Love You in 1992 and 93, and then matched by Carey's We Belong Together in 2005. The enduring dominance of songs by these two volcanoes of vulnerability seemed to prove an iron law of pop. Greatness comes from giving all of oneself. Their record has now been equaled by the 27-year-old country singer Ella Langley, a very different artist indeed. The Alabama-born Langley has been rising in country music for a couple of years now, but her second album, this year's Dandelion, has leapt the genre's fences to gain a general audience. Three Langley tracks are in the top 10 of the Billboard Hot 100. The single Choosin' Texas may soon notch its 15th week at number one, breaking Carey and Houston's records. Where those women belted loudly, Langley offers moderation, an appealing commodity in this cultural moment. Understanding that moment means understanding how the meaning of the Billboard charts has changed since Houston and Carey's days. Thanks to streaming, what matters is how often a song is played, not only how many copies it sells. That shift has helped country music, which generally seeks to weave itself into everyday life rather than stick out through spectacle, to become the popular sound of the 2020s. When Morgan Wallen's Last Night hit number one on the Hot 100 in 2023, it was the first country song to do so since 2005. Since then, 10 other country tracks have made it to the top. Out of all the arrivals to Nashville's Gold Rush, Langley doesn't seem like an obvious candidate for success. Her voice tends to stay in a middle range, with only a slight hint of huskiness. Her arrangements aim for modern classicism, placing familiar instruments, guitars, mandolins, Wurlitzer pianos, in polished productions that forego twists or anthemic build-ups. Her tattoos and brunette bangs hint at a bohemian persona, but her glossy-looking album covers and easygoing interview responses aren't very edgy. To hear what's unusual about her, you have to listen closely and pick up on what she's not saying. Choose in Texas is a breezy, sad track that sounds like an ever gentler version of the Eagles. The narrator is from Tennessee. Her man is from Texas. Langley realizes he's leaving her for a girl from his home state. The details are precisely chosen cliches. She's tipped off by, quote, the way he's two-steppin' round the room, end quote. In a lovely pedal steel-drenched second verse, she muses that he must have forgot about the Smoky Mountain rain. She doesn't sound mad or even annoyed by this betrayal. Because she knows she wasn't a match for the spark of a Texas girl, she should have known better than to take him back to Abilene. She's soberly analyzing her defeat and trying to teach herself a lesson. One of Langley's best and most telling songs is another current smash, Be Her. Over a groove punctuated by polite hand claps, Langley airs her jealousy about a woman who drinks wine by the glass, not by the bottle, who knows being rich is just a state of mind, and who stays talking to Jesus. In other words, she's fascinated by a good girl, one who's internalized the advice of her parents, the Bible, and definitely some wellness podcasts. Although the reference points here are Christian, the outlook scans a bit Buddhist. The song's subject doesn't desire much of anything. Perhaps the person Langley wants to be is not someone else, but rather a dream of her own enlightened future self. A song is a perfect Gen Z take on Jolene, Dolly Parton's country classic of female jealousy, in that it's about self-control rather than sex appeal. Langley's closest sonic predecessor, Kacey Musgraves, has long searched for transcendence, though in a more woo-woo terms than Langley does, and with the sort of neediness that often gets written off as cringe. Langley could never be cringe. She wants love, but she doesn't sweat attachment. If her guy is going to leave her for Texas, she's not going to siege the Alamo. Partying, sex, adventure, on Dandelion, she treats these like life's great temptations and more like small, manageable indulgences. Her music accordingly pares down the signature elements of a genre in which reckless abandon and defiant self-expression have long been central. I think I enjoy Langley's pale and pleasant songs, but I can barely remember how they sound when I'm not listening. Like non-alcoholic beer and an early bedtime, she's a delicacy for an overcrowded now. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website.